Well, as it's the hour of 7, and we always start on time here, as our custom, good evening, and welcome to the fourth presentation in this, our 12th series of talks on faraway places with strange-sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue back there, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster at the back taking pictures, Haiwan Wan. Daniel Peach and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauly. Our speaker tonight is a native of Daegu, South Korea, and at 13 she moved with her family to the capital of Seoul, where she attended high school, later earning a BA in English from Korea University in 1979. She says she dreamed of seeking a master's degree in the United States and made that dream a reality when she moved to Albany, New York, to attend graduate school at SUNY Albany. In an interview, she writes that she had only 10 hours of formal writing and speech training in English prior to her arrival in the United States, so the learning curve was considerable. She persevered and received her MA in 1982 and continued graduate work at the University of Kansas, from where she received her PhD in English in 1994. Upon graduation, she joined the English department at Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where she's presently an associate professor. She teaches classes on gender and racial identity in Asian and Asian American women's writing and on multicultural women's voices for the English and Women's Studies Department. Her first book, From the Promised Land to Home, was published by IDE Press in 1998, and it focused on autobiographical writings by Asian American women. Her most recent book, To Kill a Tiger, A Memoir of Korea, was published in 2010 by Overlook Press of New York, and juxtaposes her own story of growing up female in a male-dominated traditional Korean family against the historical events of World War II, the Korean War, and South Korea's tumultuous road to democracy. It's an unforgettable story. For it, she received a Bronze Award for Autobiography from the Forward Book of the Year Awards, which was selected for more than 1,600 entries, and most recently received the Gold Medal in Autobiography from the Independent Book Awards. She's presently working on Volume 2 of her memoirs, which she says will focus on her life in the United States. Please give a warm welcome to Jid Lee. Jid?
I'll tell you what. Volume 2 begins with a fascinating story. If I tell you that, you'll be able to understand how far I've come. When I first came to the U.S. in 1980, the first thing that shocked me in this country was there was so much pet food. The whole aisle was dog and cat food, and I thought, Jesus Christ, I come from a country where people are starving, and look at these decadent Americans. They have a dog on the front seat and just spill gas all over the street. Look at this damn dog food. Guess what? I've been in this country for 32 years now. I have two cats, and I'm not going to tell you how much money I spent on them. That's how I've changed. And I'm sure if some starving peasant from North Korea, if they see me, they'll say, you decadent Yankee woman. So I've gained some insight about my native country because I've been away for so long. And let me ask you, I'll try to do this in about a little over half an hour so that I can communicate with you, because interacting with my audiences is the most fun part. Let me give you, however, a pop quiz as if you were my students. Okay, you have friends from Korea, right? How many of you have friends from Korea? Okay. How many of you know Korea through industries such as Samsung and Hyundai? Yeah, I know. It goes all over the world. How many of you know that North Korea is an oppressive state? Everybody, right? Okay. How many of you know that South Korea, until a couple decades ago, was an equally oppressive place? Oh, I am so glad you know. What did you know? Can you tell us? What's your name?
Oh, my name is Pat Chai, and I was married to a South Korean, so.
You are, okay, so you heard about it.
I've been to Korea.
You've been to Korea when?
In
In 1971, that was when Park Chung-hee was in absolute power. He was just like Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. He got hold of the country through a military coup d'etat. And guess what? Did you know that behind his military coup d'etat and an extreme right-wing dictatorship, there was the United States government? He was an extreme right-wing Pinochet-style dictator. And one day he was shot to death by his chief intelligence, the head of the Korean CIA, at a geisha house. It's a really a national shame. But what is an author supposed to do? I'm sure a lot of Koreans will be upset because they will say, she's revealing all the shame. Well, I don't think on those terms. Because I think the people are thriving. The country has been an independent country for 5,000 years. It is the only country that kept its national identity among the nations around China. It is the only country that has not been absorbed into China. So you can see how tenacious it is. So I have every reason to be proud of my native country, although I'm not terribly proud of the dictatorships and the kings and queens who were really screwy. How many of you know that the current president of South Korea has nearly dismantled the free media? Oh, how do you know that, Hank? No? Okay. You know what? Most people think now South Korea has a moderate democracy. It's true. We do not have a Kim Jong-il and we do not have a gulag. But until quite recently, the remnants of the Pinochet-style dictators were very powerful, and they still are. And the current president is one of the most powerful remnants of the extreme right-wing Pinochet-style dictators. And he has successfully dismantled the media. Now, let me make an analogy. You know CNN Headline News and Fox and MSNBC, right? He has dismantled everything else except the Fox. That tells you. Of course, you know, we've come a long way because the dictator does not kill them and torture them. Park Chung-hee and his successor just kidnapped and tortured the crap out of the dissidents. And then some of them were reported as having committed a suicide. This is all in my book. Nothing works out as the script, so I'll just X out these notes that I made for 2 hours, and I'll just talk to you. Okay, let me draw a diagram here. Now, this is a simplification, but, you know, we only have an hour or so. In the Korean Peninsula, there were the superpowers, China, Japan, Russia, the United States. And we got boxed in. In South Korea, when I was growing up, there was the United States on top, and then Korean men and Korean women. And in my book, I try to explain the men in my family as, quote, victims, unquote, of this oppressive system, because my father was a political activist, and he was tortured physically in prison because he protested the U.S. occupation of the Korean Peninsula. Because when Japan was defeated in World War II, General Hodge and his army came into Korea and wanted to dismantle the grassroots socialist republic, which was already there before the United States got there. Because this grassroots socialist republic was made of patriots who had fought the Japanese occupation. Japanese occupied Korea for 36 years. Most people who fought, every one of them, every one of those people in the resistance against the Japanese was socialist. The capitalists, the right wing, were the ones who pandered the Japanese. And when the United States came in, immediately after Korea was emancipated, they listened to this right wing faction who used U.S. fear of communism. So they whispered to Hodge, said, oh, these guys are communists, they're no good. And Hodge and Truman, of course, didn't have a clue about the history of the Korean Peninsula. and how it was made up. It wasn't a Stalin-style communism. It was socialism built on the grassroots wishes. Because Korea was a peasant state, they could not afford to move into a sudden capitalism. So what they believed in was a gradual transition into a market economy. So this was a unique hybrid of Korean socialism, which was friendly to the United States. Some of the socialist leaders spoke fluent English and they wanted to befriend the United States. But the United States did not want to deal with them because they were commies. And they would walk out of the meeting because the U.S. listened only to the right wing. Now, here's the thing. There were moderate right-wing leaders who were admired by the moderate left-wing leaders. Well, let me translate it on the terms that you can understand. There were moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats. But the United States set up Sung Man-ri, who was an extreme right-wing guy, who never shed an ounce of his blood in fighting the Japanese. And he spoke fluent English, and he was a staunch anti-communist. And when he came to power, immediately after Korea was emancipated, there were 100,000 people who were killed by him and probably by the Americans who supported him because these were socialists, so to speak, because most the masses were with the socialists. And immediately after Sung Man-ri was appointed by the United States, the moderate right and the left were mysteriously killed. I mean, you can see who killed them. There's no evidence, of course. Things like that, we have no evidence for that. My father was going to Seoul National University at that time, which was like Harvard, very difficult to get in. Only the most talented young men and women went to political science department at Seoul National University back then. And the students protested the U.S. occupation because it was, from their perspective, an occupation. Because when they purged moderates on the left and the right and set up an extreme right-wing dictator, then Kim Il-sung, who was also a fighter against the Japanese occupation, declared North Korean Socialist Republic a few months later. Now, I'm sure Kim Il-sung had his own territorial ambition, but it was only after the United States had eliminated the moderate socialists and moderate capitalists that Kim Il-sung declared a North Korean Socialist Republic. So it was a really, really confusing, violent period. And the students at the university protested. And my father was kicked out of the university. I know several men who were kicked out like that. And I grew up with their children. We went to the same high school. And even after he was kicked out of the university, he was physically tortured because he was blackmarked by Sung Man-ri's secret police. What I'm trying to explain is, by explaining what happened to my father, you can understand what happened to me. Now, there is no, I'm not trying to make bones here. There is no doubt that brutal sexism prevailed in Korea, especially during the Joseon Dynasty. During the Joseon Dynasty, a widow could not even get remarried. That was how brutal it was. But I think the only way we can understand this is a comprehensive approach. See what happened to Korea politically, historically, in addition to gender issues. If we emphasize only sexism, we understand only half of it. Because I think that had the circumstances been different, my father could have grown out of his sexism a lot because he would have bloomed. He was in the shadows until he died. He lost his life in his early 20s. And for 50 years, he lived in the shadows in anger. And we grew up in the shadows. And that made him so frustrated that he took it out on his wife and children. If he had been able to have a better life and use his talents and come out into the sun, I think that his sons would have grown to be much better. You know how when you put a bunch of abandoned people in the shadows, they get locked in, they get boxed in, they never grow? So my father and brothers never had a chance to grow. We were always poor. This is what happened to him. On page 71, I will read how he was tortured by Sung Man Rhee's secret police. Kim Il-sung's right-wing counterparts in post-1945 South Korea didn't have gulags to which they could ship dissidents, and they didn't practice hagiography. But since the 38th parallel was drawn between the two Koreas, the South Korean dictators waged a ruthless campaign to eliminate individuals they saw as possible troublemakers, as North Korea did. As one of those presumed, quote, guilty, unquote, father was arrested in 1949. When the police came, he was teaching at a teacher's college after having been expelled from Seoul National University. They took him as a, quote, thought criminal, unquote, and tortured him, threatening to kill him if he had harbored any seditious thought against the, quote, democracy, unquote. A lot of quotes here, you can see why. They hung him upside down from the ceiling, hitting him on the calves with a heavy baton. While forcing buckets of water down his throat, they also kicked him in the belly in an attempt to rupture his stomach. Fortunately, father had to spend only 3 months in prison. I'm sure Kim Jong-il had his dissidents tortured like this too in North Korea. Mother's brother pulled the strings on his behalf, and father was released much more quickly than any of his peers. Although my uncle, too, was a socialist, at that time, the vast majority of intelligent young men and women were socialists because of the historical circumstances I explained it to you. Did you know that this happened in Indonesia and the Philippines? In the Philippines, when they were liberated from the Spanish, they wanted to opt for socialism. But Uncle Sam went in, and a million Filipinos were killed. In Indonesia, the same thing happened. In Vietnam, North Vietnamese eventually won, but that's an exception. And in China, too, you know, although Mao Zedong was a horrible dictator, the United States supported his right-wing dictator, Chiang Kai-shek, and when he left, most Chinese felt liberated. And at first, the communists led by Mao Zedong did a good job. Later, he turned into a heinous dictator. Okay, let me continue to read. Although my uncle, too, was a socialist and was known as such in the intellectual circles he belonged to, he wasn't as yet a marked man and had clout with other lawyers on the right and left. Having passed the Japanese bar exams to become the first modern Korean lawyer, he was a celebrity among them, and they were eager to ingratiate themselves. This uncle of mine was the matchmaker between my father and my mother. Now, this is so ironical. You know, these men who worked for the justice and equality, for the freedom of their country, were so sexist. My mother didn't get to see my father's face even once. His best friend, my uncle, and my maternal grandfather and my father's paternal grandfather arranged the marriage. It was an arranged marriage. And on the day they got married in the village, my father did not arrive on time. Guess what? The bus broke down. So he and his best man had to rent a donkey. And the donkey was so damn slow. So they ran, and then the wedding took place in my mother's house at midnight. Fascinating episode, right? Okay. And my father also was one of those 12 men who passed the preliminary bar exam in Japan. There were only 12 men in that year in the whole Manchuria and Taiwan and Japan and China. So he was a brilliant man, but because he was on the wrong side, he never got to see the sun for half a century. And this really reinforced his sexist pattern of behavior. You know, as I said, if he had grown, if he had been able to grow and use his talents, I think he would have been a lot less sexist. But you know how people are? Look, you know, if you grow up in a ghetto, you end up repeating what you learned. He just ended up repeating the sexism he picked up from his culture. So he picked up my sister's, he handpicked my sister's husband. And I did not like him at all. He shows up in my dreams, still telling me what to do, this old man. So we fight. But ironically, I am the one who worked so hard to make the world know him. You know, human relationships are so ironical. I think it's because he gave me the trauma that he had received. You know the psychological, you know the term in psychology, trauma bonding? He pulled me through the same trauma, and I got to understand what his trauma was. When he picked up handpicked his son-in-law, I said, I was 15 years old, and I said, I am not going to do this. I'm going to leave the country. When I was 15 years old, I was determined to leave the country because I was afraid if I had remained in Korea, he would handpick my husband. And I went to college there, and I fought my father and brothers all the time. But again, you know what? Thomas Jefferson said, history is made by ironies and contradictions. As sexist as they were, these men in my family, I call them the three men of the family, taught me something. They gave me a sense of justice. In one of the pages, I call them the princes who woke up the sleeping princess in me. They gave me a sense of justice. They gave me the ability to read between the lines. When newspapers were cranking out reports of the economic miracles, we knew how many industrial accidents there were. South Korea had the highest number of industrial accidents, the most heinous abuse of human rights. I will read that to you in a moment. They taught me how to read the newspapers between the lines. And they gave me the sense of justice, but they said, I cannot apply to the second sex. I said, yes, I will. So they gave me the weapon with which I could fight them. And ironically, I'm grateful. I hope that comes through in the book. So I tell my women audiences who are concerned about gender, that's good, but please see something else, which is the political, historical side of the issue. And I tell my male audiences, would you please see the gender issues so that we can have a complete understanding. This uncle of mine also, you know, who passed the Japanese bar exam, he was blacklisted by the South Korean Supreme Court, Sungman Rhee's Supreme Court. And he wasn't sure whether he could survive in South Korea or not. So he went to Japan, and then from Japan, he went to North Korea. And we do not know what happened to him. My guess is that he died on a gulag because Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il's father, brutally purged intellectual socialists who came from South Korea to monopolize the power. It's been almost 60 years, and my mother still keeps the house, and she still has a bank account in case her nephews and nieces show up. So I tell her, be very careful because some starving North Korean may show up and pose as your nephew. She would be duped because before she dies, she's 86 years old, and her health isn't that good. Before she dies, she would like to find out. And we don't know. This is a dilemma because if her brother had died on a gulag, I don't want her to know. If he had survived and if his children are doing okay, I would want her to know. But there's no way we can find out. So I would rather just leave it as a question mark. And if I could find out where they are, where my cousins are, I would love to go because I'm a U.S. citizen. But, you know, if I go, North Korean government will do everything to ooze dollars out of me. They love U.S. dollars. Isn't that hypocritical? They condemn the United States as a Yankee imperialist nation, and yet they love dollars. I'm sure some of them hide Levi jeans in a closet. Okay, the book starts with my experience as a child. To me, the most immediate experience was the sexual discrimination that I got in the hands of my parents. Because you know what? Every child understands the most immediate experience. I have to be honest about that. In the first 50 pages or so, I describe these male chauvinist pigs. They almost look like caricatures, but eventually they have complex characters. And I have bitter but also sweet feelings about these men. I told you that I feel grateful, you know. My oldest brother, I think he still is a male chauvinist pig, but he is the greatest, oldest son I've ever seen. My father was a male chauvinist pig, but he was an absolutely devoted patriarch. And when he shows up in my dreams and still tells me what to do, I'm grateful. Because sometimes he tells me what to do, what's in store for me. He's worried about me. I think that's in my subconscious. You know, democracy is a strange beast. In this country, only the white male had democracy. And Thomas Jefferson said, history is made by violent ironies and contradictions. At first, the book starts with a tiger's stomach. Let me read that to you, just for the first part. And then I'll try to finish soon. My nightmare and my dream, because thanks to my nightmare, I had a dream. Started when I was 6 years old, a child sick in bed. Your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, she was quite a woman, grandmother said. She volunteered to be eaten alive by a tiger for her descendants because a Buddhist monk told her if she's eaten alive by a tiger, then her descendants would prosper. So we did prosper until my grandfather screwed up everything. Because my grandfather fell in love with a new woman, so to speak. My grandmother was illiterate. He fell in love with a Western educated woman and left his family and had three illegitimate children, one of whom committed suicide, and then he committed suicide at the end too. This self-sacrifice, the command for self-sacrifice, runs throughout the family. I felt that it has to stop with my generation. Joseon Dynasty was able to continue for that long, partly because of women's total self-sacrifice. And my six times removed grandmother, she volunteered to sacrifice herself because that was a brave thing to do for a woman at that time. But I gradually extended this metaphor to include the man in my family and the man who died in prison to institute democracy in South Korea, because so many nameless men and women were tortured to death and in prisons. And recently, just a couple weeks ago, a man who used to be a dissident, student protest organizer, in the 1980s, when Park Jong-hee's successor took over, he was tortured nearly to death. And because of the sicknesses that he contracted from the torture, he did not live out to fulfill his natural lifespan. And there was a funeral, and his wife told the media, and the funeral was on TV. At least he earned a name. Well, like people like my father, they're nameless. They're buried in the shadows. And that is why I wrote this book. It took me 15 summers. Now, while I was writing it, I had to be tenured. So It was a very long struggle. You can see that I shed many tears. But I don't know how to say this. You know, I haven't entirely forgiven my father because I see my sister's husband's behavior and my mind rushes back to his choice. I don't know if I have still forgiven him. Now, I forgave him for what he did to me because we fought a lot. But actually, I got out of it. And then since I got out of the country, he supported me generously. He saved every penny to support me, and he would be very proud of me. And he learned a lot from his conflict with me. But my sister is still in that marriage, still. And when I go home, her husband is the last person I want to see. But I love his children, so he comes with his children. And I can't say no. She's still married to him. He's a good man, but here comes a story. He grew up in a miserable background. He's also a product of the Korean War. His father went to socialist meetings organized by the North Korean army that occupied South Korea for a while. And because of that, somebody snitched on him to the police and he got killed. So the whole family were condemned as children of the Red and grew up in a village starving, totally ostracized. That really screwed them up. And his siblings aren't entirely normal. I think I've given you enough, but guess what, okay? Here's the thing. I'll read one more thing here, and then one more thing, and then I'll let you go. Okay, I want to talk about the brutalities of the Park Jung-hee's rule. Okay, page 178. This is only one of the things that he did. Here is just one example of the extent of Park's terror. In 1974, he fabricated an incident called the People's Revolutionary Party Movement. Oh, I give him one credit. He built the foundation for the economic development. However, he built it with 18 years of absolute power. Number one, the highest number of industrial accidents in the world, forced seizures, total media blackout, and arrested 23 people on the common cover-all charge of national security violation. He accused them of association with the North Korean Reds, had them tortured to the point of a false confession, and then sentenced 8 of them to death and the rest to 15 years or life in prison. To keep them from talking, he had the 8 death row inmates executed within 24 hours of sentencing. Even serial killers are given more time than that. One of the 8 individuals executed was a friend of a father's, my father's, a construction company owner whose name was Do Ye-jong. He used to come to our house in Daegu to visit father, to have long whispered conversations with him over coffee mother made for them. After he was executed, father told his boys about him, his boys, not me or girls. And the boys were relieved father wasn't implicated in the conspiracy. Guilt by association was national law. Anyone who was vaguely associated with a suspect could be arrested and tortured. So you can see my ambivalence about the United States. I hated the United States government, but I also wanted to come to this country so badly because that was the only way I could avoid having my man handpicked by my father. And my father was invited to George Peabody College for a year, paid by the Secretary of State of the United States. He fell in love with the United States. How could he forgive the U.S. government? If you were in his position, could you? But then he would always talk about how great this country was. So I wanted to go to this great country, and I've come here and had a chance to realize that my American dream was only partly true. But I do like it here because this is why I have faith in the United States. It is the country that I have the most hope for, because even in Bowling Green, Kentucky, I can have this kind of a crowd. This is a wonderful infrastructure. You know, I was talking about this in the restaurant where we were having dinner. London is England, Paris is France, but New York is not the United States. Bowling Green is the United States, too. And that is one of the most remarkable things about this country. And that is why people flock to this country still. And that's what attracted me to this country. But I realized that this is not what I imagined to be. Of course, I was a dreamer. I dreamed of a utopia. Reality is much different. Look at page 344. Look how many people are dying because they don't have health insurance. South Korea has the best health insurance. If you put $100 a month into it, you have everything covered. You don't need a good job. In this country, look, my health insurance is some $600 a month, and MTSU, my employer, pays 3/4 of it. I can't retire because of the health insurance. Page 344, this is my American dream. When I go to, I say that there is a state in my dream, a no-name state between California and Oregon. I named it as no-name state. And then in my dream, my father and I are walking on a trail in no-name state. And then we see a deer walking toward us because there's no hunting in the state because it's a utopia. However, when I wake up, I see something else. Okay, here's what happened. In shock, I watched the beautiful animal become covered with the snow in an instant, the deer who's walking toward us. The woods, too, turned white, freezing in the sub-zero temperature that turned the whole state into a giant ice mountain. Everything died in a wink, leaving me to shudder in the infinite white terror. Waking up, I thought I could decipher the meaning of the dream. The state, which I was to call no-name state for the rest of my life, was an imaginary United States to which I had moved from Korea, a utopia where human beings could not live. It was a place where everything was perfect and nothing could survive, a country reigned by death and governed by a flawless and hence lifeless logic. Father, whom I never called dead except in my dreams, came to tell me this simple truth, to utter the words that peace and tranquility, that's my alter ego, offered to his soulmate only in silence. Father was the artist who had given his eyes to paint visions of a perfect world, the warrior who had devoted his youth to doing what was right for his country, and the first one to realize that the world he had fought so hard for was merely an idea. Because if you look at socialist republics like North Korea and Cuba, they're dying. But let's not generalize. I'm not condemning European-style socialism. So I'm not condemning socialism. I hope you understand what I'm talking about. As I was finally awakened to the truth that the America I had constructed in my head was only an idea, I too was afraid that I was going blind, tormented in my soul by the price I had to pay. I found myself hanging in the air between the two homes, living in the wind that blew across the Pacific. Yet, ironically, it was this vain search for the America I had come to that was going to keep me on my toes, and I knew it. Because I would never find this Neverland, I would forever search for it, refusing to give up. I would stay on in America, looking every day for a country within the country. I hope you believe me. This is the microcosm of the United States that I came to, because Bowling Green is the United States. And we still have this idea, unquote, of what this country should be. And that's what attracts people, although in reality it's much different. But still, we have this idea. And to practice this idea, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy died. And my father, who had such an anti-American feeling, he loved Bobby Kennedy. And when Bobby Kennedy was killed, he cried. So you cannot say that he's an anti-American. No. historically, I still believe that there is this idea, italicized, that is running in this country, although a lot of it has been damaged. And we want to keep this idea alive. Although I see so many problems in this country, I decided to stay because I thought that I can help this country to realize this idea. So that's why I teach American literature and multicultural literature and women's studies from my perspective, because I think that that's what my father gave me. And one more thing. And then final thing that I want to talk about is, you know, we talk about love, all that. What is love? I'm not sure. I know what love is not, but for me, a true definition of love is the love that survived the threat of hate. Only when you survive the threat of hate, you understand what true love is. And I think that my family overcame the threat of hate because of what happened to my father. There was, and my grandmother, all that. We had a rough life. Still, however, we kept it together. And I think that we are a loving family, although we were dysfunctional sometimes, because we survived the threat of hate. And that's what I would like to read, and then I will finish talking. This is when I was moving, when my siblings and I were moving to Seoul, and we saw our father waiting at the Seoul station. Running to meet father on the train platform in Seoul station, I saw the face that his children had always loved. Now, I know that it was love that my family was unable to express except in the form of quarrels governing our house. It was love in a dust storm. Blinded by the wind, we each made the mistake of believing the others were throwing dirt at us and picked up the same dirt to hurt each other in return. I tried to say everything in this one paragraph, tried to distill it, because I could go on and long and say, oh, well, it was because of the historical circumstances that threatened to tear us apart, all that, you know. Instead of writing 5 pages, I thought this one paragraph would say everything. We had a dust storm, but we thought that the dust storm was deliberately created by one of us. But that's not true. So I will stop talking. You know, it's been already 40 minutes. And I would be honored if you ask me questions. The first person who asked me a question, $20. Well, actually, I only have $10. Sorry. Maybe I gave you so much information that the details that you vaguely guessed, but, you know.
Well, I'll ask first. Yeah. What started your interest in English?
Well, I started to learn
novels about Wuthering Heights. And
because I wanted to escape from the Confucian patriarchy and from the shadows. And the West appealed to me. I thought the West could be my asylum, which is not. Yeah, and that's why I picked up all those books, you know. I was a dreamy girl, and I thought if I read Jane Eyre, I would be a free woman and all that. My grandmother's rival, my grandfather's illegitimate wife, spoke English, and my mother didn't, and my father spoke English. So I thought if I could speak English, then I would be a free woman. But at that also, you know, most of us wanted to be good in English because it was a very important part of education. And when we started to learn English when I was 12 years old, it was a national obsession, learning English. But to me, it was more than that. Yes?
The title of the book, where did that?
It's the tiger that devoured my great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. So I have to kill the tiger. But I don't want to kill the tiger, because if I kill the tiger, I'll be dead. as long as you are alive, you have a situation that you wish to escape from. If I keep you here for 3 hours, this will be a tiger's stomach. And you would want to get out of here. It sounds like to kill a mockingbird, you know? Yeah. Margaret?
If you don't mind me asking this, I was curious what happened to your younger brother, because we haven't
heard that much about him. No, I have two older brothers.
Okay.
The oldest son, and then I call him Big Brother.
Yeah,
right. That's in Korea, you don't call your older siblings by their first names. So, Les Big Brother, I call him Les Big Brother. He's bankrupt. He's a parasite. He's, he read Kafka when he was 15 years old. He never did anything with his brain. He still justifies himself. He's a genius in self-justification. But he also gave me, the way that he interpreted literature, only a genius could do it. He introduced me to literature and gave me so much insight, he and his brother both. But he didn't do anything with his talent. You know, when an ambitious person is lazy, look, when a whale rots, it can contaminate the whole ocean. You know, when a dolphin dies, when a dolphin is sick, then I don't think you can see it nearly as much, the impact. But he's a whale. He's got a giant brain, but he never amounted to be anything. He's one of those people that I really don't want to see, but he also comes with his children. Big Brother, the oldest son, and I are putting his girls through college. So it's ironical because my mother always shielded him from all the blame. I think there's something Freudian here. Les Big Brother looks exactly like my father, whom she worshipped. She still defends him. And he comes to manipulate to get money out of her. And he's done it so many times. But he comes with the children, and I can't say no, because when I go home, I want to see the children. He comes with the children. And my sister's husband also comes with the children. You know, family is a complicated unit, don't you think? We talk about family values and family values. Well, of course I love my family, but it's really a bizarre institution. They can shackle you.
Back here?
Yes. Yes, hi.
I remember you saying that it took you 15 semesters.
Yes,
right?
15 summers.
15 summers.
Uh-huh.
Is that your first book then?
My first book was a book of criticism, which I sold away to a second-rate commercial press because I wasn't interested any longer. Because I wasn't interested in, quite frankly, explaining anyone else's work, because I was so desperate to write this. You know, Toni Morrison said on Oprah, people asked her, why did she start to write? She said, if she didn't, she would die. I thought if I didn't write this book, I would die. Because who would know? Who else would know what happened in Korea? Everybody who read this book says, if you want to know what happened in Korea, you should read this book. And if you want to know what happened in North Korea, you should read this book. Why North Koreans are so aggressive? Why North Korea hates the United States? I'm not saying North Korea is justified. I don't want to live there, you know? But there is a reason. Tell you what, look at page 337. There was a grassroots socialist republic in the whole Korean peninsula. When we were divided, North Korea had a reason to get angry. Now, I'm not saying it was a good idea for them to declare war. Okay, it's on page 337. If you know what the United States did to North Korea, you may understand why they're so angry. Again, I don't like what they're doing now. Look at this. In 1950, Douglas MacArthur seriously contemplated dropping atomic bombs over the northern tip of the Korean Peninsula. North Koreans did not use bombs, they used guns. North Koreans did not rape South Korean women. There might have been a few isolated cases. I heard this from eyewitness accounts, from women who saw North Korean soldiers. those who remained in Seoul to welcome the North Korean army because they saw the North Korean army as liberators. During the Korean War, the Joint Chiefs of Staff came close to using them several times over North Korea. In 1951, the U.S. military also dispatched to Pyongyang a solitary B-52 bomber in an attempt to terrorize North Korea, the state that never used bombs in its warfare with South Korea. I wondered if Bush-supporting Americans knew that it was their own country that had placed a pile of nuclear weapons near the DMZ in 1957 to intimidate the then non-nuclear North. The United States intimidated the non-nuclear North Korea to build nuclear weapons, period. I also wondered, and yet George Bush called North Korea an axis of evil. I also wondered if the American people ever knew the open secret that their own country had continued its rehearsals for a long-range bombing strike upon North Korea until 1998. For at least 7 more years after the nuclear weapons were withdrawn in 1991 under the pressure of the South Korean peace movement. I include these bits and pieces of historical knowledge because I grew up in an intensely political, historical family, and my mother told me all about this because she told me in the form of a woman's oral history about what happened to my father. He himself was silent. Nowadays, we don't know what's going to happen in North Korea. We were talking about this at the dinner table too. North Korea is still like Joseon Dynasty, you know. Crown Prince, the King Crown Prince, and then now Kim Jong-il's son. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's a puppet. Probably his mother's family, his maternal relatives probably run the show. Because it used to be like that in Joseon Dynasty too. A lot of times kings were the puppet, and the Crown Prince's mothers or the king's mothers and their families ran the whole country. It's ironical, isn't it? It's such a patriarchal country, but still, mothers were so powerful. Women were not powerful, but mothers were powerful.
Other question. You write about the great tragedy of the comfort women in
your
book about what happened to these southern...
I used to know I know a few comfort women, personally.
You might tell, I'm not sure.
Yeah, do you know what comfort women were? Comfort women were Asian women from Taiwan and China and Korea and the Philippines who were drafted by the U.S. From the Japanese government to serve as unpaid sexual slaves for the Japanese army. They were tricked and lied to by the Japanese who said they were going to work at a factory or as nurses. When they got there, there were comfort stations waiting for them at the army barracks. And then behind the curtain, sometimes on weekends, they were forced to have sex by 100, 200 Japanese soldiers a day. And most of them died because they could not survive. And the Japanese would shoot them when they couldn't walk. And then they would create a mass grave and bury those comfort women who were barely alive. And today, even now, the Japanese government denies that there were anything like comfort women. But the citizens know. So the Japanese citizens created an organization and offered to pay compensation. But most comfort women had said no because they want an official apology from the Japanese government.
Not the money.
Not the money. That's not what they're looking for.
How do the view the Japanese after such a long occupation?
You know,
is there some tension?
Politically, there's a lot of tension. The governments still hate each other. But for a long time, South Korea provided labor for Japan. So Japan was the ones who owned the capital. So we were like mice in front of a cat. Then when South Korea began to rise economically, then the comfort women began to come forward. So all has to do with money. And still, there is a tension between the governments, and people want the government to apologize. But there's something really weird happening. The Korean, South Korean popular culture is so popular, it almost conquered the Japanese women's hearts. These Japanese women are rising up against their own government to speak for Korean comfort women. So there's a lot of exchange culturally. Japanese women love to come to Korea. They love Korean actors. There are four Korean actors who are called the kings or emperors of Japan, because these Japanese women, just, you know, their dream, for the, their lifetime dream is to see these actors and shake hands with them. Well, because they think that Japanese men are samurais, they're brutal and cruel, but Korean men are tender, which is not true at all. I don't think men are tender animals anyway. So I don't think women are tender animals either. Anyway, a lot of cultural exchange, young Japanese men and women love Korea. They love Korean movie, they love Korean history, but their government has eliminated the records of the Japanese occupation of the rest of Asia, including comfort women. So comfort women disappeared from the Japanese history textbooks. So the government, you see, the government has done this. However, there's a lot of exchange between the Japanese and Koreans culturally as peoples. So it's in a weird state. And so we think that these Korean actors did so much more than the whole government.
Further questions? Yes, back here. Yeah. Well, we'll give you first in the back. Yeah.
Dr. Lee, is that your picture on the front of the book?
Is that your picture on the front?
No, that's the one who's holding me. That's my older sister who married the guy handpicked by my father.
Huh? She's holding you?
Yeah, she's holding me. Actually, she's beautiful, but that was right after the Korean War when we lived in a house with crumbling dirt walls. And she used to be called the Liz Taylor of Korea. She was that beautiful, but I think that he really screwed her up. Her husband ruined her beauty. I don't know why I feel this way. Because you know what? He followed the norms. But the problem is that when he got paid $2,000, he spent $1,200 and brought $800 home. And she had to raise two children with it. And she snowballed his money. They have multi-million dollars in asset, purely thanks to her. I think he grew on her blood. And he still spends money like water. I think it's because he wants to overcompensate. Because he grew up, when he was growing up in a village, his whole family starved, and his little brother died while eating a rice cake. You know, have you heard of this? When Jews who were released from the concentration camp, they were given liquid food because they had been starved so long. His little brother had starved for so long that when he had a rice cake, suddenly that was too much and he died instantly. He grew up in an environment like that, and I wonder why my father handpicked him. That's a very good question mark. I still don't know. And that's my sister holding me.
Question here. What between South Korea and China, what's the relationship now? I mean, with
South Korea provides China technology, high tech. And Chinese love South Korea's economy. And then economy, and then South Korea, as an exchange, as a trade-off, imports a lot of cheap Chinese goods. And when we go to a store, there are two different peanuts from China, from Korea. And my mother says, don't buy peanuts from China. It has too much insecticide. And discriminating shoppers do not buy things from China. But China, you know, that's what South Koreans used to do 30 years ago. Now, you know, we are busy raising dogs. We are busy spending thousands of dollars on our cats and dogs, and we don't want to buy goods that we used to sell. That's what, when you grow economically, you know, you want to move up. So we don't want to buy cheap things with a lot of insecticides. And it's interesting, the United States, one of the reasons why the United States cannot attack North Korea for a preemptive strike is because of China. China does not want refugees from North Korea. So many refugees from North Korea in China right now. They escape to Chinese embassy, and the guys, they climb up the wall, and the Chinese guys guarding the embassy on top of the wall push them. Somebody else.
Back here.
It was fun at supper, and I think that it might be fun to hear again. When you came to the United States, how much English did you know, and how did you learn English?
You know, I had 10 hours of experience in speaking and writing in English, so it was virtually hell. It takes so long to explain it. I'll give you one interesting episode. You know, I watched movies, and the problem was when I could speak because I could look at the person eye to eye, and they could understand, but listening was hell, especially people with southern accent. Although I was at Albany, New York, and Kansas, Midwestern accent was hard too. Well, I bought a VCR and played the same movie 20 times until I could pick up all the dialogue. That's how I did it. But there's a horror story about it. I think that it is in and of itself would be about 200 pages.
We'll wait for that. Next
memoir.
Any further questions? Right here, yes.
Seeing what happened to Berlin when they split that in half, and then when the wall came down, that was tremendously hard, I think, on both sides. Do you think Korea will ever...
I think it will happen. I think it will happen. But, you know, the case of Germany is different from North and South Korea because Germany was an aggressor. Korea was surrounded by superpowers. I don't think Germany suffered from the same situation. And when the Berlin Wall came down, I was exhilarated. And I was thinking, oh, when is that going to happen to Korea? That's the first thing that I thought about. From what I heard, West Berlin is giving a lot of economic aid to East Berlin, East Germany, and I think that when it happens, it should happen gradually because there's just too much gap between North and South Korea. Look, I told you, if they see me with the two cats, they'll say, oh, that would be good food. No, I would be horrified. That's why it should happen gradually, but I think South Korea will virtually have to feed North Korea. That's what
that happened in Germany,
yes. Mm-hmm. An incredible amount of hardship in North Korea. But if we try to help them now, the money will end up in the hands of corrupt party officials. My second cousin went to North Korea with fertilizer, and he asked a woman on the street, she looked like she was 60 years old. He asked her, how old are you? She said she was 35. Oh, that's how bad it is. And the party officials wanted some cash, dollars. So he gave them $600 US dollars in cash.
Just so he could give the fertilizer?
Yep, so that they could give the fertilizer. And you know who's in the forefront of the economic aid in North Korea? And Hyundai. You know Hyundai? Mm-hmm. The guy who established Hyundai, he was a golf buddy of Park Chung-hee, the dictator, the extreme right-wing dictator. They played golf together, and that's how Hyundai grew. Had the most severe labor history. They used to kidnap labor leaders. When I went home in 1988, I saw in a newspaper, the management of Hyundai kidnapped a labor leader, the labor leader, in a wheat sack. Kept him for 24 hours in a wheat sack. That's how brutal it was. Guess what, though? They wanna develop some North Korean places. Kumgang Mountains is beautiful places. They have been pouring billions of dollars into North Korea, including economic aid and developing the tourist attraction. So this is how ironical it is. This guy who was one of the right hands of the Pinochet-style dictator, he is in the forefront of investing in North Korea. Isn't that ironical? He's done a lot of good things.
Maybe he can see down the road.
He came from North Korea during the Korean War. So he comes from North Korea. When North and South Korea opened up for the first time in the year 2000, he took something like 2,200 cows to North Korea so that North Korean farmers would be able to raise them. I wouldn't be surprised if they were all butchered, however. And his children are now trying to develop those places as tourist attractions because they've got the money. But of course it's self-interested because you know what? They can use the resources and cheap labor in North Korea, of course. They never forget the self-interested motive on the part of the businessman.
Don't forget Texas and Mexico.
Yes. Of Texas and Mexico.
On that note, I'm going to draw this. On behalf of WK Libraries, we want, and our sponsor, the Friends Organization, want to thank you for coming out tonight. We hope you'll join us. Our next speaker in our Faraway Places series will be the first week of April, when we'll have a speaker from Spain talking about Ernest Hemingway and his relationship with Spain. We hope you'll stop by and chat with Miss Lee and buy a copy of her book. Thanks, and good evening.